Books on Tape presents My Life by William Jefferson Clinton, Volume 2, read by Michael Beck, with the epilogue read by the author.
Chapter 30. On Sunday, January 17th, Al and Tipper Gore, Hillary, and I began inaugural week with a tour of Monticello, followed by a discussion of Thomas Jefferson's importance to America with young people. After the event, we boarded our bus for the 120-mile trip to Washington. The bus symbolized our commitment to giving the federal government back to the people. Besides, we cherished the fond memories it held, and we wanted one last ride. We stopped for a brief church service in the pretty Shenandoah Valley town of Culpeper, then made our way to Washington. Just as in the campaign, there were well-wishers and a few critics along the way. By the time we got to the Capitol, the public events of our inaugural entitled An American Reunion, New Beginnings, Renewed Hope, were already underway. Harry Thomason, Rahm Emanuel, and Mel French, a friend from Arkansas who would become chief of protocol in my second term, had organized an extraordinary series of events, with as many as possible free of charge or within the price range of the working people who had elected me. On Sunday and Monday, the mall between the Capitol building and the Washington Monument was filled by an outdoor festival featuring food, music, and crafts. That night we had a call for reunion concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with a star-studded lineup including Diana Ross and Bob Dylan, who thrilled the crowd of 200,000 that filled the space from the stage all the way back to the Washington Monument. Standing beneath Lincoln's statue, I gave a short speech appealing for national unity, saying that Lincoln gave new life to Jefferson's dream that we are all created free and equal. After the concert, the Gores and my family led a procession of thousands of people carrying flashlights across the Potomac River on Memorial Bridge to the Lady Bird Johnson Circle just outside Arlington National Cemetery. At 6 p.m., we rang a replica of the Liberty Bell to start Bells of Hope ringing all across America and even aboard the space shuttle Endeavour. Then there was a fireworks display followed by several receptions. By the time we got back to Blair House, the official guest residence just across the street from the White House, we were tired but exhilarated, and before falling asleep, I took some time to review the latest draft of my inaugural address. I still wasn't satisfied with it. Compared with my campaign speeches, it seemed stilted. I knew it had to be more dignified, but I didn't want it to drag. I did like one passage, built around the idea that our new beginning had forced the spring to come to America on this cold winter day. It was the brainchild of my friend Father Tim Healy, former president of Georgetown University. Tim had died suddenly of a heart attack while walking through Newark Airport a few weeks after the election. When friends went to his apartment, they found in his typewriter the beginning of a letter to me that included suggested language for the inaugural speech. His phrase, "force the spring," struck all of us, and I wanted to use it in his memory. Monday, January 18th, was the holiday celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. In the morning, I held a reception for the diplomatic representatives of other nations in the inner quadrangle at Georgetown, addressing them from the steps of Old North Building. It was the same spot on which George Washington stood in 1797, and the great French general and Revolutionary War hero Lafayette spoke in 1824. I told the ambassadors that my foreign policy would be built on three pillars: economic security at home, restructuring the armed forces to meet the new challenges of the post-Cold War world, and support for democratic values across the globe. The day before, President Bush had ordered an airstrike on a suspected weapons production site in Iraq, and on this day, U.S. planes hit Saddam Hussein's air defense positions. I supported the effort to bring Saddam into full compliance with UN resolutions and asked the diplomats to emphasize that to their governments. After the diplomatic event, I spoke to Georgetown students and alumni, including many of my old classmates, urging them to support my national service initiative. From Georgetown, we drove to Howard University for a ceremony honoring Dr. King, then to a luncheon at the beautiful Folger Library for more than 50 people Al, Tipper, Hillary, and I met during the campaign, who had made a strong impression on us. We called them Faces of Hope because of their courage in the face of adversity or their innovative ways of dealing with contemporary challenges. We wanted to thank these people for inspiring us and to remind everyone amidst the glamour of the inaugural week that a lot of Americans were still having a hard time. The Faces of Hope included two former members of rival gangs in Los Angeles who joined forces after the riots to give kids a better future. Two of the Vietnam veterans who had sent me their medals, a school principal who had created a violence-free magnet school in Chicago's highest crime neighborhood with students who regularly scored above state and national learning levels, a Texas judge who had created an innovative program for troubled kids, a young Arizona boy who had made me more aware of the family pressures caused by the extra hours his father had to work, a Native American doctor from Montana who worked to improve mental health services to her people, men who had lost their jobs to low-wage foreign competition, people struggling with costly health problems the government didn't help with, a young entrepreneur scrapping for venture capital, people who ran community centers for broken families, a policeman's widow whose husband was killed by a mental patient who bought a handgun without a background check, an 18-year-old financial wizard who was already working on Wall Street, a woman who had started a large recycling program at her plant, and many others. Michael Morrison, the young man who drove his wheelchair down an icy New Hampshire highway to work for me, was there. So was Demetrius Theophanis, the Greek immigrant from New York who had asked me to make his boy free. All of the Faces of Hope had taught me something about the pain and promise of America in 1992, but none more than Louise and Clifford Ray, whose three sons were hemophiliacs who had contracted the HIV virus through transfusions of tainted blood. They also had a daughter who was not infected. Frightened people in their small Florida community pushed to have the Ray boys removed from school, fearing that their children could be infected if one of them started bleeding and the blood got on them. The Rays filed a lawsuit to keep the kids in class and settled it out of court, then decided to move to Sarasota, a larger city, where the school officials welcomed them. The oldest son, Ricky, was obviously very ill and fighting to hang on to his life. After the election, I called Ricky in the hospital to encourage him and invite him to the inauguration. He was looking forward to coming, but he didn't make it. At 15, he lost his fight, just 5 weeks before I became president. I was so glad that the Rays came to the luncheon anyway. When I took office, they championed the cause of hemophiliacs with AIDS and successfully lobbied Congress for the passage of the Ricky Ray Hemophilia Relief Fund. But it took 8 long years, and their grief still wasn't over. In October 2000, 3 months before the end of my presidency, the Ray's second son, Robert, died of AIDS at 22. If only antiretroviral therapy had been available a few years earlier. Now that it is, I spend a lot of time trying to get the medicine to many of the Ricky Rays across the world. I want them to be faces of hope, too. On Tuesday morning, Hillary and I started the day with a visit to the graves of John and Robert Kennedy at Arlington National Cemetery. Accompanied by John Kennedy Jr., Ethel Kennedy, several of her children, and Senator Ted Kennedy, I knelt at the eternal flame and said a short prayer, thanking God for their lives and service and asking for wisdom and strength in the great adventures just ahead. At noon, I hosted a lunch for my fellow governors at the Library of Congress, thanking them for all I had learned from them in the past 12 years. After an afternoon event at the Kennedy Center highlighting America's children, we drove out to the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland, for the gala concert where Barbra Streisand, Wynton Marsalis, K.D. Lang, rock legends Chuck Berry and Little Richard, Michael Jackson, Aretha Franklin, Jack Nicholson, Bill Cosby, the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater, and other artists kept us entertained for hours. Fleetwood Mac brought the crowd to its feet with our campaign theme song, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. After the concert, there was a late-night prayer service at the First Baptist Church, and it was after midnight when I got back to Blair House. Though it was getting better, I still wasn't satisfied with the inaugural address. My speechwriters, Michael Waldman and David Kusnet, must have been tearing their hair out, because as we practiced between 1 and 4 in the morning on Inauguration Day, I was still changing it. Bruce Lindsay, Paul Bagala, Bruce Reed, George Stephanopoulos, Michael Sheehan, and my wordsmith friends Tommy Kaplan and Taylor Branch stayed up with me. So did Al Gore. The terrific staff at Blair House was used to taking care of foreign heads of state who kept all kinds of hours, so they were ready with gallons of coffee to keep us awake and snacks to keep us in a reasonably good humor. By the time I went to bed for a couple of hours' sleep, I was feeling better about the speech. Wednesday morning dawned cold and clear. I began the day with an early morning security briefing. Then I received instructions on how my military aide would handle the launching of our nuclear weapons. The president has 5 military aides, 1 outstanding young officer from each service branch. One of them is near him at all times. Though a nuclear exchange seemed unthinkable with the Cold War over, assuming the control of our arsenal was a sober reminder of the responsibilities just a few hours away. There's a difference between knowing about the presidency and actually being president. It's hard to describe in words, but I left Blair House with my eagerness tempered by humility. The last activity before the inauguration was a prayer service at the Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church. It was important to me. With input from Hillary and Al Gore, I had picked the participating clergy, the singers, and the music. Hillary's family and mine were both there. Mother was beaming, Roger was grinning and enjoying the music. Both our pastors from home participated in the service, as did Al and Tipper's ministers, and George Stephanopoulos's father, the Greek Orthodox dean of the Holy Trinity Cathedral in New York. Father Otto Hentz, who almost 30 years earlier had asked me to consider becoming a Jesuit, said a prayer. Rabbi Gene Levy from Little Rock and Imam Wallace D. Mohammed spoke. Several black clergymen who were friends of mine participated, with Dr. Gardner Taylor, one of America's greatest preachers of any race or denomination, giving the principal address. My Pentecostal friends from Arkansas and Louisiana sang, along with Phil Driscoll, a fabulous singer and trumpeter Al knew from Tennessee. And Carolyn Staley sang, Be Not Afraid, one of my favorite hymns and a good lesson for the day. Tears welled up in my eyes several times during the service, and I left it uplifted and ready for the hours ahead. We went back to Blair House to look at the speech for the last time. It had gotten a lot better since 4 a.m. At 10, Hillary, Chelsea, and I walked across the street to the White House, where we were met on the front steps by President and Mrs. Bush, who took us inside for coffee with the Gores and the Quails. Ron and Alma Brown were also there. I wanted Ron to share a moment he had done so much to make possible. I was struck by how well President and Mrs. Bush dealt with a painful situation and a sad parting. It was obvious that they had become close to several members of the staff and would miss and be missed by them. At about 10:45, we all got into limousines. Following tradition, President Bush and I rode together with Speaker Foley and Wendell Ford, the gravelly-voiced senator from Kentucky, who was co-chairman of the Joint Congressional Committee on Inaugural Ceremonies, and who had worked hard for the narrow victory that Al and I had won in his state. Fortunately, the ongoing Capitol Restoration Project had required the last three inaugurations to be held on the building's west front. Before that, they had taken place on the other side, facing the Supreme Court and the Library of Congress. Most of the people who came could not have seen the ceremonies from that viewpoint. The crowd, which filled the large grounds of the Capitol and spilled back over onto the Mall and up Constitution and Pennsylvania Avenues, was estimated by the National Park Service to be between 280,000 and 300,000 people. Whatever the number, the throng was big and full of all kinds of people, old and young, of all races and faiths, from all walks of life. I was happy that so many people who had made this day possible were there to share in it. Many of the FOBs who came illustrated the extent to which I was indebted to my personal friends, Marcia Scott and Martha Whetstone, who organized my campaigns in Northern California, were old friends from Arkansas. Sheila Bromfman, leader of the Arkansas Travelers, had lived around the corner from Hillary and me when I was Attorney General. Dave Matter, my leader in western Pennsylvania, had succeeded me as class president at Georgetown. Bob Raymar and Tom Schneider, two of my most important fundraisers, were friends from law school and Renaissance Weekend. There were so many people like them who had made this day possible. The ceremony started at 11:30. All the principals walked out onto the platform according to protocol order with their congressional escorts. President Bush went just before me, with the Marine Band under Colonel John Bourgeois playing Hail to the Chief for both of us. I gazed out onto the vast crowd. Then Al Gore took the oath of office, administered by Supreme Court Justice Byron White. The oath was originally going to be administered by retired Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, a great civil rights lawyer whom President Johnson had made the first black on the high court, but he had fallen ill. It would have been unusual for a retired justice to do the honors, but Marshall's son, Thurgood Jr., was on Gore's staff. Another son, John, was a Virginia state trooper who had led our inaugural motorcade from Monticello to Washington. Marshall died 4 days after the inauguration. He was mourned, missed, and deeply appreciated by the legions of Americans who remembered what America was like before he set out to change it. After the oath, the great mezzo-soprano Marilyn Horne, whom I had first met when she performed in Little Rock a few years earlier, sang a medley of classic American songs. Then it was my turn. Hillary stood to my left holding our family Bible. With Chelsea on my right, I put my left hand on the Bible, raised my right hand, and repeated the oath of office after Chief Justice Rehnquist, solemnly swearing to faithfully execute the office of the President and to the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God. I shook hands with the Chief Justice and President Bush, then hugged Hillary and Chelsea and told them I loved them. Then Senator Wendell Ford called me to the podium as the President of the United States. I began by placing the present moment in the stream of American history. Today we celebrate the mystery of American renewal. This ceremony is held in the depth of winter. But by the words we speak and the faces we show the world, we force the spring. A spring reborn in the world's oldest democracy that brings forth the vision and courage to reinvent America. When our founders boldly declared America's independence to the world and our purposes to the Almighty, they knew that America, to endure, would have to change. Each generation of Americans must define what it means to be an American. After a salute to President Bush, I described the current situation. Today, a generation raised in the shadows of the Cold War assumes new responsibilities in a world warmed by the sunshine of freedom, but threatened still by ancient hatreds and new plagues. Raised in unrivaled prosperity, we inherit an economy that is still the world's strongest, but is weakened. Profound and powerful forces are shaking and remaking our world, and the urgent question of our time is whether we can make change our friend and not our enemy. There is nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America. Still, I warned, it will not be easy. It will require sacrifice. We must provide for our nation the way a family provides for its children. I ask my fellow citizens to think of posterity, the world to come, the world for whom we hold our ideals, from whom we have borrowed our planet, and to whom we bear sacred responsibility. We must do what America does best, offer more opportunity to all, and demand responsibility from all. I said that in our time, there is no longer a clear division between what is foreign and what is domestic. The world economy, the world environment, the world AIDS crisis, the world arms race, they affect us all. America must continue to lead the world we did so much to make. I close the speech with a challenge to the American people, telling them that by their votes they had forced the spring, but that government alone could not create the nation they wanted. You too must play your part in our renewal. I challenge a new generation of young Americans to a season of service. There is so much to be done. From this joyful mountaintop of celebration, we hear a call to service in the valley. We have heard the trumpets. We have changed the guard. And now, each in our way and with God's help, we must answer the call. Although several commentators panned the speech, saying it was devoid of both ringing phrases and compelling specifics, I felt good about it. It had flashes of eloquence. It was clear. It said we were going to reduce the deficit while increasing critical investments in our future, and it challenged the American people to do more to help those in need and to heal our divisions. And it was short. The third shortest inaugural address in history, after Lincoln's second inaugural, the greatest of them all, and Washington's second speech, which lasted less than 2 minutes. Essentially, Washington just said, "Thanks, I'm going back to work, and if I don't do a good job, reprimand me." By contrast, William Henry Harrison gave the longest address in history, in 1841, speaking without a coat on a cold day for well over an hour, and catching a bad case of pneumonia, which cost him his life 33 days later. At least I was mercifully and uncharacteristically brief, and the people knew how I saw the world and what I intended to do. By far the most beautiful words of the day were spoken by Maya Angelou, a tall woman with a deep, strong voice, whom I had asked to write a poem for the occasion, the first poet to do so since Robert Frost spoke at President Kennedy's inauguration in 1961. I had followed Maya's career since I read her memoir, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, which recounts her early years as a traumatized mute girl in a poor black community in Stamps, Arkansas. Maya's poem, On the Pulse of Morning, riveted the crowd, built on powerful images of a rock to stand on, a river to rest by, and a tree with roots in all the cultures and kinds that make up the American mosaic, the poem issued a passionate plea in the form of a neighborly invitation. Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning for you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, and if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes upon the day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Here on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes and into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning. Billy Graham ended our good morning with a brief benediction, and Hillary and I left the stage to accompany the Bushes down the back steps of the Capitol, where the presidential helicopter, Marine One, was waiting to take them on the first leg of their journey home. We went back inside for lunch with the congressional committee, then drove up Pennsylvania Avenue toward the viewing stand in front of the White House for the inaugural parade. With Chelsea, we got out of the car and walked the last few blocks of the route so that we could wave to the crowds packed several deep along the way. After the parade, we went into our new home for the first time, with only about 2 hours to greet the staff, rest, and get ready for the evening. Miraculously, the movers had gotten all our belongings in during the inaugural ceremonies and the parade. At 7, we started our evening marathon with a dinner, followed by visits to all 11 inaugural balls. My brother sang for me at the MTV Youth Ball, and at another I played a tenor saxophone duet on Night Train with Clarence Clemons. However, at most of the balls, Hillary and I would first say a few words of thanks, then dance to a few bars of one of our favorite songs, It Had to Be You, showing off her beautiful purple gown. Meanwhile, Chelsea was off with her friends from Arkansas at the Youth Ball, and Al and Tipper kept their own schedule. At the Tennessee Ball, Paul Simon regaled them with his hit, You Can Call Me Al. At the Arkansas Ball, I introduced Mother to Barbara Streisand and told them both I thought they'd get along. They did more than that. They became fast friends, and Barbara called my mother every week until she died. I still have a picture of them walking hand in hand on that inaugural evening. When we got back to the White House, it was after 2 a.m. We had to be up the next morning for a public reception, but I was too excited to go right to bed. We had a full house. Hillary's parents, Mother and Dick, our siblings, Chelsea's friends from home, and our friends Jim and Diane Blair, and Harry and Linda Thomason. Only our parents had retired. I wanted to look around. We had been on the second floor living quarters before, but this was different. It was beginning to sink in that we actually lived there and would have to make it a home. Most of the rooms had high ceilings and beautiful but comfortable furniture. The presidential bedroom and living room faced the south, with a small room off the bedroom that would become Hillary's sitting room. Chelsea had a bedroom and study across the hall, just beyond the formal dining room and the small kitchen. At the other end of the hall were the main guest bedrooms, one of which had been Lincoln's office and has one of his handwritten copies of the Gettysburg Address. Next to the Lincoln bedroom is the Treaty Room, so named because the treaty ending the Spanish-American War was signed there in 1898. For several years, it had been the private office of the president, usually configured with multiple televisions so the chief executive could watch all the news programs at once. I believe President Bush had 4 TVs there. I decided I wanted it to be a quiet place where I could read, reflect, listen to music, and hold small meetings. The White House carpenters made me floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, and the staff brought up the table on which the Spanish-American War Treaty had been signed. In 1869, it had been Ulysses Grant's cabinet table, with space for the president and his 7 department heads to sit around it. Since 1898, it had been used for the signing of all treaties, including the temporary nuclear test ban under President Kennedy and the Camp David Accords under President Carter. Before the year was out, I would be using it too. I filled out the room with a late 18th century Chippendale sofa, the oldest piece of furniture in the White House collection, and an antique table bought by Mary Todd Lincoln, on which we put the silver commemorative cup from the 1898 treaty. When I got my books and CDs in and hung some of my old pictures, including an 1860 photo of Abraham Lincoln and Yusuf Karsh's famous photograph of Churchill, the place had a comfortable, peaceful atmosphere in which I would spend countless hours in the years ahead. On my first day as president, I started out by taking Mother down to the Rose Garden to show her exactly where I stood when I shook hands with President Kennedy almost 30 years ago. Then, in a departure from traditional practice, we opened the White House to the public, providing tickets to 2,000 people who had been selected in a postcard lottery. Al, Tipper, Hillary, and I stood in line shaking hands with the ticket holders, then with others who waited in the cold rain for their time to walk through the lower south entrance into the diplomatic reception room to say hello. One determined young man without a ticket had hitchhiked overnight to the White House with his sleeping bag. After 6 hours, we had to stop, so I went outside to speak to the rest of the crowd gathered on the south lawn. That night, Hillary and I stood in line for another few hours to greet our friends from Arkansas and classmates from Georgetown, Wellesley, and Yale. A few months after the inauguration, a book was published filled with beautiful photographs that capture the excitement and meaning of the inaugural week, with an explanatory text written by Rebecca Buffum Taylor. In her epilogue to the book, Taylor writes, "A shift in political values takes time. Even if successful, its clarity must wait until months or years have passed, until the lens has been extended and recedes again, until far and middle distance merge with what can be seen today." The words were penetrating and probably correct, but I couldn't wait years, months, or even days to see if the campaign and the inauguration had affected a shift in values, deepening the roots and broadening the reach of the American community. I had too much to do, and once again the work quickly turned from poetry to prose, not all of it pretty. Chapter 31. The next year involved an amazing combination of major legislative achievements, frustrations and successes in foreign policy, unforeseen events, personal tragedy, honest errors, and clumsy violations of the Washington culture, which, when combined with compulsive leaking by a few staffers, ensured press coverage that often resembled what I'd experienced during the New York primary. On January 22nd, we announced that Zoe Baird had withdrawn her name from consideration for Attorney General. Since we had learned about her employment of illegal immigrants and her failure to pay Social Security taxes for them during the vetting process, I had to say that we had failed to evaluate the matter properly and that I, not she, was responsible for the situation. Zoe had not misled us in any way. When the household workers were hired, she had just gotten a new job and her husband had the summer off from teaching. Apparently, each assumed the other had handled the tax matter. I believed her and kept working for her nomination for 3 weeks after she first offered to withdraw it. Later, I appointed Zoe to the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, where she made a real contribution to the work Admiral Crow's group did. On the same day, the press became infuriated with the new White House when we denied them the privilege, which they had had for years, of walking from the press room located between the West Wing and the residence up to the press secretary's office on the first floor near the cabinet room. This strolling allowed them to hang out in the halls and pepper whoever came by with questions. Apparently, a couple of people high up in the Bush administration had mentioned to their new counterparts that this arrangement impeded efficiency and increased leaks, and the decision was made to change it. I don't recall being consulted about it, but perhaps I was. The press raised the roof, but we stuck with the decision, figuring they'd get over it. There's no question that the new policy contributed to freer movement and conversation among the staff, but it's hard to say it was worth the animosity it engendered. And since in the first few months the White House leaked worse than a tar paper shack with holes in the roof and gaps in the walls, it's impossible to say that confining the press to quarters did much good. That afternoon, the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, I issued executive orders ending the Reagan-Bush ban on fetal tissue research, abolishing the so-called Mexico City rule, which prohibited federal aid to international planning agencies that were in any way involved in abortions, and reversing the Bush gag rule, barring abortion counseling at family planning clinics that receive federal funds. I had pledged to take these actions in the campaign, and I believed in them. Fetal tissue research was essential to finding better treatments for Parkinson's disease, diabetes, and other conditions. The Mexico City rule arguably led to more abortions by reducing the availability of information on alternative family planning measures. And the gag rule used federal funds to prevent family planning clinics from telling pregnant women, often frightened, young, and alone, about an option the Supreme Court had declared a constitutional right. Federal funds still could not be used to fund abortions at home or abroad. On January 25th, Chelsea's first day at her new school, I announced that Hillary would head a task force to come up with a comprehensive health care plan, working with Ira Magaziner as the lead staff person, domestic policy advisor Carol Rasko, and Judy Fader, who had led our health care transition team. I was pleased that Ira had agreed to work on health care. We had been friends since 1969, when he had come to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar a year after I did. Now a successful businessman, he had worked on the campaign economic team. Ira believed delivering universal health coverage was both morally and economically imperative. I knew he would give Hillary the kind of support she needed for the grueling task ahead of us. Heading up the effort to reform health care was an unprecedented thing for a First Lady to do, as was my decision to give Hillary and her staff offices in the West Wing, where the policy action is, as opposed to the traditional office space in the East Wing, where the social affairs of the White House are run. Both decisions were controversial. When it came to the First Lady's role, it seemed Washington was more conservative than Arkansas. I decided Hillary should lead the health care effort because she cared and knew a lot about the issue. She had time to do the job right, and I thought she would be able to be an honest broker among all the competing interests in the healthcare industry, government agencies, and consumer groups. I knew the whole enterprise was risky. Harry Truman's attempt to provide universal health coverage had nearly destroyed his presidency, and Nixon and Carter never even got their bills out of committee. With the most Democratic Congress in decades, Lyndon Johnson got Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the poor, but didn't even try to insure the rest of those without coverage. Nevertheless, I thought we should try for universal coverage, which every other wealthy nation had long enjoyed for both health and economic reasons. Almost 40 million people had no health insurance, yet we were spending 14% of our gross national product on health care, 4% more than Canada, the country with the next highest rate. On the night of the 25th, at their urgent request, I met with the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss the gays in the military issue. Earlier in the day, the New York Times had reported that, because of strong military opposition to the change, I would delay issuing formal regulations lifting the ban for 6 months, while the views of senior officers as well as practical problems were considered. It was a reasonable thing to do. When Harry Truman ordered the racial integration of the military, he had given the Pentagon even more time to figure out how to carry it out in a way that was consistent with its primary mission of maintaining a well-prepared, cohesive fighting force with high morale. In the meantime, Secretary Aspin would tell the military to stop asking recruits about their sexual orientation and to stop discharging homosexual men and women who had not been discovered to have committed a homosexual act, which was a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The Joint Chiefs' early request for a meeting created a problem. I was more than willing to hear them out, but I didn't want the issue to get any more publicity than it already was receiving, not because I was trying to hide my position, but because I didn't want the public to think I was paying more attention to it than to the economy. That's exactly what congressional Republicans wanted the American people to think. Senator Dole was already talking about passing a resolution removing my authority to lift the ban. He clearly wanted this to be the defining issue of my first weeks in office. In the meeting, the chiefs acknowledged that there were thousands of gay men and women serving with distinction in the 1.8 million member military, but they maintained that letting them serve openly would be, in General Powell's words, prejudicial to good order and discipline. The rest of the Joint Chiefs were with the chairman. When I raised the fact that it apparently had cost the military $500 million to kick 17,000 homosexuals out of the service in the previous decade, despite a government report saying there was no reason to believe they could not serve effectively, the chiefs replied that it was worth it to preserve unit cohesion and morale. The Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Frank Kelso, said the Navy had the greatest practical problems given the close and isolated living arrangements on ships. The Army Chief, General Gordon Sullivan, and U.S. Air Force General Merrill McPeak were opposed, too. But the most adamant opponent was the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Carl Mundy. He was concerned about more than appearances and practicalities. He believed that homosexuality was immoral, and that if gays were permitted to serve openly, the military would be condoning immoral behavior and could no longer attract the finest young Americans. I disagreed with Mundy, but I liked him. In fact, I liked and respected them all. They had given me their honest opinions, yet had made it clear that if I ordered them to take action, they'd do the best job they could, although if called to testify before Congress, they would have to state their views frankly. A couple of days later, I had another night meeting on the issue with members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, including Senators Sam Nunn, James Exon, Carl Levin, Robert Byrd, Edward Kennedy, Bob Graham, Jeff Bingaman, John Glenn, Richard Shelby, Joe Lieberman, and Chuck Robb. Nunn, while opposed to my position, had agreed to the 6-month delay. Some of my staffers were upset with him for his early and forceful opposition, but I wasn't. After all, he was personally conservative, and as chairman of the committee, he honored the military culture and saw it as his duty to protect it. He was not alone. Charlie Moskos, the Northwestern University sociologist who had worked with Nunn and me on the DLC National Service proposal and who said he had known a gay officer during the Korean War, was also against lifting the ban, saying that it preserved the expectation of privacy to which soldiers living in close quarters were entitled. Moskos said we should stick with what the great majority of military people wanted, because the main thing we needed in the military was the ability and willingness to fight. The problem I saw with his argument and Sam Nunn's is that they could have been used with equal force against Truman's order on integration or against current efforts to open more positions to women in the military. Senator Byrd took a harder line than Nunn, echoing what I had heard from General Mundy. He believed homosexuality was a sin, said he would never let his grandson, whom he adored, join a military that admitted gays, and asserted that one reason the Roman Empire fell was the acceptance of pervasive homosexual conduct in the Roman legions from Julius Caesar on down. In contrast to Byrd and Nunn, Chuck Robb, who was conservative on many issues and had survived heated combat in Vietnam, supported my position based on his wartime contact with men who were both gay and brave. He wasn't the only Vietnam combat veteran in Congress who felt that way. The cultural divide was partly, but not completely, partisan and generational. Some younger Democrats opposed lifting the ban, while some older Republicans were for lifting it, including Lawrence Korb and Barry Goldwater. Korb, who had enforced the ban as an Assistant Secretary of Defense under Reagan, said it was not necessary for maintaining the quality and strength of our forces. Goldwater, a former chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, a veteran, and the founder of the Arizona National Guard, was an old-fashioned conservative with libertarian instincts. In a statement published in the Washington Post, He said that allowing gays to serve was not a call for cultural license, but a reaffirmation of the American value of extending opportunity to responsible citizens and limiting the reach of government into people's private lives. In his typically blunt way, he said he didn't care whether a soldier was straight, but whether he could shoot straight. As things turned out, Goldwater's support and all my arguments were academic. The House passed a resolution opposing my position by more than 3-1. The Senate opposition was not as great, but was still substantial. That meant that if I persisted, the Congress would overturn my position with an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill that I couldn't easily veto. And even if I did, the veto would be overridden in both houses. While all this was going on, I saw a poll showing that by 48-45%, the public disagreed with my position. The numbers didn't look too bad for such a controversial issue, but they were, and they showed why Congress thought it was a dead-bang loser for them. Only 16% of the electorate strongly approved of lifting the ban, while 33% very strongly disapproved. Those were the people whose votes could be influenced by a congressman's position. It's hard to get politicians in swing districts to take a 17% deficit on any issue into an election. Interestingly, the biggest divisions were these. Self-identified born-again Christians opposed my position 70-22%, while people who said they knew homosexuals personally approved of it 66-33%. With congressional defeat inevitable, Les Aspin worked with Colin Powell and the Joint Chiefs on a compromise. Almost exactly 6 months later, on July 19th, I went to the National Defense University at Fort McNair to announce it to the officers in attendance. "Don't ask, don't tell" basically said that if you say you're gay, it's presumed that you intend to violate the Uniform Code of Military Justice and you can be removed, unless you can convince your commander you're celibate and therefore not in violation of the code. But if you don't say you're gay, the following things will not lead to your removal: marching in a gay rights parade in civilian clothes, hanging out in gay bars or with known homosexuals, being on homosexual mailing lists, and living with a person of the same sex who is the beneficiary of your life insurance policy. On paper, the military had moved a long way to live and let live, while holding on to the idea that it couldn't acknowledge gays without approving of homosexuality and compromising morale and cohesion. In practice, it often didn't work out that way. Many anti-gay officers simply ignored the new policy and worked even harder to root out homosexuals, costing the military millions of dollars that would have been far better spent making America more secure. In the short run, I got the worst of both worlds. I lost the fight, and the gay community was highly critical of me for the compromise, simply refusing to acknowledge the consequences of having so little support in Congress and giving me little credit for lifting another ban on gays, the ban against serving in critical national security positions, or for the substantial number of gays and lesbians who were working throughout the administration. By contrast, Senator Dole won big. By raising the issue early and repeatedly, he guaranteed it so much publicity that it appeared I was working on little else, which caused a lot of Americans who had elected me to fix the economy to wonder what on earth I was doing and whether they had made a mistake. I was finding it a challenge to keep another campaign commitment, cutting the White House staff by 25%. It was a nightmare for Mac McClarty, especially since we had a more ambitious agenda than the previous administrations and were getting more than twice as much mail. On February 9th, just a week before I was slated to announce my economic program, I proposed the 25% reduction, cutting the staff by 350 people, down to 1,044 employees. Everybody took a hit. Even Hillary's office would be smaller than Barbara Bush's, though she would take on greater responsibilities. The reduction I regretted most was the elimination of 20 career positions in the correspondence section. I would have preferred to reduce their numbers by attrition, but Max said there was no other way to meet the goal. Besides, we had to have some money to modernize the White House. The staff couldn't even send and receive email, and the phone system hadn't been changed since the Carter years. We couldn't do conference calls, but anyone could press one of the big lighted extension buttons and listen in on someone else's conversation, including mine. Soon we had a better system installed. We also beefed up one part of the White House staff, the casework operation that was designed to help individual citizens who had personal problems with the federal government, often involving an effort to obtain disability, veterans, or other benefits. Usually citizens call on their U.S. senators or representatives for help in such matters, but because I had run a highly personalized campaign, many Americans felt they could call on me. I got an especially memorable request on February 20th when Peter Jennings, the ABC News anchor, moderated a televised children's town meeting in the White House in which young people between the ages of 8 and 15 asked me questions. The kids asked if I helped Chelsea with her homework, why no women had been elected president, what I would do to help Los Angeles after the riots, how health care would be paid for, and whether I could do anything to stop violence in schools. A lot of them were interested in the environment. But one of the children wanted help. Anastasia Somoza was a beautiful girl from New York City who was confined to a wheelchair because of cerebral palsy. She explained that she had a twin sister, Alba, who also had cerebral palsy, but who, unlike her, couldn't speak. So because she can't speak, they put her in a special education class, but she uses computers to speak, and I would like her to be in a regular education class just like me. Anastasia said she and her parents were convinced that Alba could do regular schoolwork if given a chance. Federal law required children with disabilities to be educated in the least restrictive environment, but the critical decision about what is least restrictive is made at the child's school. It took about a year, but eventually Alba got into a regular class. Hillary and I kept in touch with the Somoza family, and in 2002, I spoke at the girls' high school graduation. They both went on to college because Anastasia and her parents were determined to give Alba all the opportunities she deserved and weren't shy about asking others, including me, to help. Every month, the agency liaison who headed the casework operation sent me a report on the people we had helped, along with a few of the moving thank you letters they sent. In addition to the staff cuts, I announced an executive order to cut administrative expenses 3% throughout the government and a reduction in the salaries of top appointees and in their perks, like limousine service and private dining rooms. In a move that would prove to be a tremendous morale booster, I changed the rules of the White House mess to allow more junior staff to use what had been the private preserve of high-level White House officials. Our young staffers were working long hours and weekends, and it seemed foolish to me to require them all to leave for lunch, order in, or bring a paper bag with food from home. Besides, access to the White House mess implied that they, too, were important. The mess was a wood-paneled room with good food prepared by Navy personnel. I ordered lunch from it almost every day and enjoyed going down to visit with the young people who worked in the kitchen. Once a week, they served Mexican dishes I especially liked. After I left office, the mess was again closed to all but senior staff. I believe our policy was good for morale and productivity. With all the extra work and fewer people to do it, we would have to rely more than ever not only on those junior staffers, but also on the 1,000-plus volunteers who put in long hours, some of them virtually full-time. The volunteers opened the mail, sent form replies when appropriate, filled requests for information, and did countless other tasks without which the White House would have been far less responsive to the American people. All the volunteers got in return for their efforts, apart from the satisfaction of serving, was an annual thank-you reception Hillary and I hosted for them on the South Lawn. The White House couldn't function without them. Besides the specific cuts I had already decided on, I was convinced that with a longer-term systematic approach, we could save a lot more money and improve government services. In Arkansas, I had initiated a total quality management program that had achieved positive results. On March 3rd, I announced that Al Gore would lead a 6-month review of all federal operations. Al took to the job like a duck to water, bringing in outside experts and consulting widely with government employees. He kept at it for 8 years, helping us to eliminate hundreds of programs and 16,000 pages of regulations, to reduce the federal workforce by 300,000, making this the smallest federal government since 1960, and to save $136 million in tax money. While we were getting organized and dealing with the controversies in the press, most of my time in January and February was devoted to filling in the details of the economic plan. On Sunday, January 24th, Lloyd Benson appeared on Meet the Press. He was supposed to give non-specific answers to all questions regarding the details of the plan, but he went a little further than that, announcing that we would propose a consumption tax of some kind and that a broad-based energy tax was under consideration. The next day, interest rates on the government's 30-year bond fell from 7.29 to 7.19%, the lowest rate in 6 years. Meanwhile, we were struggling with the budget details. All the spending cuts and taxes that raised real money were controversial. For example, when I met with Senate and House leaders on the budget, Leon Panetta suggested that we have a one-time 3-month delay in increasing the Social Security cost of living allowance. Most experts agreed that the COLA was too high given the low rate of inflation, and the delay would save $15 billion over 5 years. Senator Mitchell said that the suggested delay was regressive and unfair, and that he couldn't support it. Neither would the other senators. We'd have to find that $15 billion elsewhere. Over the weekend of January 30th to 31st, I brought the cabinet and senior White House staff to Camp David, the presidential retreat in Maryland's Catoctin Mountains. Camp David is a beautiful wooded site with comfortable cabins and recreational facilities, staffed by men and women from the Navy and the Marine Corps. It was the perfect setting for us to get to know one another better and talk about the year ahead. I also invited Stan Greenberg, Paul Begala, and Mandy Grunwald. They felt that they had been shut out of the transition, and that an obsession with the deficit had overtaken every other objective I had advanced in the campaign. They thought Al and I were courting disaster by disregarding the deeper concerns and interest of the people who had elected us. I sympathized with them. For one thing, they hadn't been in on the hours of discussions that led most of us to the conclusion that if we didn't deal with the deficit, we couldn't achieve sustained strong growth, and that my other campaign commitments, at least those that cost money, would die in the stagnant backwater of a sluggish economy. I let Mandy and Stan start the discussion. Mandy outlined the anxiety of the middle class about jobs, retirement, health care, and education. Stan said that voters' most important concerns were, in order, jobs, health care reform, welfare reform, and then deficit reduction, and that if deficit reduction was going to require the middle class to pay more taxes, I had darn sure better do something else for them. Hillary then described how we'd failed in Arkansas in my first term by doing too many things at once, without a clear storyline and an effort to prepare people for a long, sustained struggle. Then she told them about the success we'd had the second time around by focusing on one or two issues every 2 years and laying out long-term goals, along with short-term benchmarks of progress against which we could be judged. That kind of approach, she said, enabled me to develop a storyline people could understand and support. In response, someone pointed out that we couldn't develop a storyline as long as we were awash in leaks, all of which concerned the most controversial proposals. After the weekend, the consultants tried to come up with a communication strategy that would take us beyond the daily leaks and controversies. The rest of the retreat was devoted to more informal, personal conversations. On Saturday night, there was a session run by a facilitator who was a friend of Al Gore's, in which we were supposed to bond by sitting in a group, taking turns telling something about ourselves the others didn't know. Though the exercise got mixed reviews, I actually enjoyed it and managed to confess that as a child, I was overweight and often ridiculed. Lloyd Benson thought the whole exercise was silly and went back to his cabin. If there was something about him the rest of us didn't know, it was intentional. Bob Rubin stayed, but said he didn't have anything to say. Apparently, such group unburdening wasn't the key to his success at Goldman Sachs. Warren Christopher did participate, probably because he was the most disciplined man on the planet and thought this baby boomer version of Chinese water torture would somehow strengthen his already considerable character. All in all, the weekend was helpful, but the real bonding would come in the fires of the struggles, victories, and defeats that lay ahead. On Sunday night, we were back in the White House to host the annual National Governors Association dinner. It was Hillary's first formal event as First Lady, and she was nervous, but it went well. The governors were concerned about the economy, which diminished state revenues, forcing them to cut services, raise taxes, or both. They understood the necessity of reducing the deficit, but didn't want it to come at their expense, in the form of responsibility shifting from the federal government to the states without funds being provided to pay for them. On February 5th, I signed my first bill into law, keeping another campaign commitment. With the Family and Medical Leave Act, the United States at last joined more than 150 other countries in guaranteeing workers some time off when a baby is born or a family member is sick. The bill's principal sponsor, my longtime friend Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, had worked for years to enact it. President Bush had vetoed it twice, saying it would prove too burdensome for business. While the legislation had some strong Republican supporters, most Republicans had voted against it for the same reason. I believed that family leave would be good for the economy. With most parents in the workforce by choice or necessity, it is imperative that Americans be able to do well both on the job and at home. People who are worried about their infants or their sick parents are less productive than those who go to work knowing they've done right by their families. During my time as president, more than 35 million people would take advantage of the family and medical leave law. In the next 8 years, and even after I left office, more people would mention it to me than any other bill I signed. Many of their stories were powerful. Early one Sunday morning when I came in for my jog, I ran into a family touring the White House. One of the children, a teenage girl, was in a wheelchair and obviously very ill. I greeted them and said if they'd wait for me to shower and get dressed for church, I'd take them into the Oval Office for a picture. They waited and we had a good visit. I especially enjoyed my talk with the brave young girl. As I walked away, her father grabbed my arm and turned around saying, "My little girl is probably not going to make it. The last 3 weeks I've spent with her have been the most important of my life. I couldn't have done it without the family leave law." In early 2001, when I took my first shuttle flight from New York to Washington as a private citizen, one of the flight attendants told me that both her parents had been desperately ill at the same time, one with cancer, the other with Alzheimer's. She said there was no one to care for them in their last days except her and her sister, and they wouldn't have been able to do it without the family leave law. "You know, the Republicans are always talking about family values," she said, "but I think how your parents die is an important part of family values." On February 11th, as we worked to finish the economic plan, I finally got an attorney general, having decided after a false start or two on Janet Reno, the prosecuting attorney of Dade County, Florida. I had known about and admired Janet's work for years, especially her innovative drug courts, which gave first-time offenders the chance to avoid going to jail if they agreed to undergo drug treatment and check in regularly with the court. My brother-in-law, Hugh Rodham, had worked in the Miami Drug Court as an attorney with the Public Defender's Office. At his invitation, I had attended two sessions of the court myself in the 1980s and was struck by the unusual but effective way the prosecutor, defense lawyer, and judge worked together to convince the defendants that this was their last opportunity to stay out of prison. The program was very successful, with a much lower recidivism rate than the prison system, at far less cost to the taxpayers. In the campaign, I had pledged to support federal funding to establish drug courts based on the Miami model all across the country. Senator Bob Graham gave Reno a glowing endorsement when I called him. So did my friend Diane Blair, who had gone to Cornell with her 30 years earlier. So did Vince Foster, who was a very good judge of people. After he interviewed Janet, he called me and said in his droll way, "I think we've got a live one." Reno also was immensely popular with her constituents, based on her reputation as a no-nonsense, tough but fair prosecutor. She was a native Floridian, about 6 feet tall, and had never married. Public service was her life, and she had performed it well. I thought she could strengthen the often frayed relationships between federal law enforcement and its state and local counterparts. It concerned me a little that, like me, she was a stranger to Washington's ways, but in Miami she had had extensive experience working with federal authorities on immigration and narcotics cases, and I thought she would learn enough to get along. Over the weekend, we worked hard to finish the economic plan. Paul Begala had come to work in the White House a couple of weeks earlier, in large measure to help me explain what I was about to do in a way that was consistent with my campaign message of restoring opportunity for the middle class, something he believed most members of the economic team didn't care enough about. Begala felt that the entire team should stress 3 points: that deficit reduction is not an end in itself, but the means to achieve the real objectives: economic growth, more jobs, and higher incomes. That our plan represented a fundamental change in the way government had been working, ending the irresponsibility and unfairness of the past by asking the wealthy big corporations and other special interests that had benefited disproportionately from the tax cuts and deficits of the 1980s to pay their fair share of cleaning up the mess. And that we should not say we were asking people to sacrifice, but to contribute to America's renewal, a more patriotic and positive formulation. Begala wrote a memo containing his arguments and suggesting a new theme. It's not the deficit, stupid. Gene Sperling, Bob Reich, and George Stephanopoulos agreed with Paul and were glad to have some inside help in arguing the message. While all this was going on in public, we were struggling hard with some big questions. By far the largest was whether to include health care reform along with the economic plan in the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act. There was a compelling argument for doing so. First, the budget, unlike all other legislation, isn't subject to the filibuster rule, the Senate practice that allows just 41 senators to kill any bill by debating it to death, blocking a vote until the Senate has to move on to other business. Since the Senate had 44 Republicans, the probability that they would at least try to filibuster health care was high. Hillary and Ira Magaziner badly wanted health care in the budget. The congressional leaders were open to it, and Dick Gephardt had urged Hillary to do it, because he was sure the Republican senators would try to filibuster health care if it were proposed by itself. George Mitchell was sympathetic for another reason. If health care reform were introduced as a separate bill, it would be referred to the Senate Finance Committee, whose chairman, Senator Pat Moynihan of New York, was, to put it mildly, skeptical that we could come up with a workable health care plan so quickly. Moynihan recommended that we first do welfare reform and spend the next 2 years developing a health care proposal. The economic team was adamantly opposed to including health care in the budget, and they had good reasons, too. Ira Magaziner and many healthcare economists believed, correctly as it turned out, that greater competition in the healthcare marketplace, which our plan would promote, would produce significant savings without price controls. But the Congressional Budget Office would not give credit for these savings in any budget we presented. Thus, to provide universal coverage, we had either to include a provision for backup price controls in the plan, raise taxes and cut other spending even further, or reduce the deficit target, which might adversely affect our strategy to lower interest rates. I decided to delay the decision until after I put the details of the economic plan before the people and the Congress. Not long afterward, the decision was made for me. On March 11th, Senator Robert Byrd, the senior Senate Democrat and ultimate authority on the body's rules, told us he would not make an exception for health care to the Byrd rule, which prohibited the inclusion of non-generic items in the budget reconciliation bill. We had enlisted everyone we could think of to make the case to Byrd, but he was adamant that health care reform could not be construed as part of the basic budget process. Now, if the Republicans could sustain a filibuster, our health care plan would be dead on arrival. In the second week of February, we decided to kick the health care can down the road and complete the rest of the economic plan. I had become deeply immersed in the details of budgeting, determined to understand the human impact of our decisions. Most of the team wanted to cut farm supports and other rural programs, which they thought were unjustifiable. Alice Rivlin pushed hard for the cuts, suggesting I could then say I had ended welfare for farmers as we know it. It was a takeoff on one of my best campaign lines, a pledge to end welfare as we know it. I reminded my mostly urban budgeteers that farmers were good people who had chosen hard work in an uncertain environment, and though we had to make some cuts in their programs, we don't have to enjoy it. Since we couldn't restructure the whole farm program, reduce the subsidies in other nations' budgets, or eliminate all the foreign barriers to our food exports, we ended up reducing the existing farm benefits modestly. But I didn't enjoy it. Another thing we had to consider in proposing cuts, of course, was whether they had a chance to pass. For example, someone said we could save a lot of money by eliminating all the so-called highway demonstration projects, which were specific spending items members of Congress obtained for their districts or states. When the suggestion came up, my new congressional liaison, Howard Pastor, shook his head in disbelief. Pastor had worked in both the House and Senate, and for both Democratic and Republican lobbying firms. A New Yorker with a brusque, candid manner, Howard snapped, "How many votes does the bond market have?" Of course, he knew we had to convince the bond market that our deficit reduction plan was credible, but he wanted us to remember that it first had to pass, and inflicting personal pain on members of Congress was unlikely to prove a successful strategy. Some of the proposals we considered were so absurd, they were comical. When someone suggested we impose fees for Coast Guard services, I asked how they would work. It was explained that the Coast Guard was quite often called upon to bring in boats that were in distress, often due to the negligence of the operators. I laughed and said, "So when we pull up alongside or throw down a rope from a helicopter before we do a rescue, we're going to ask, Visa, MasterCard?" We let that one go. But eventually, we did come up with more than 150 budget cuts. Deciding on the tax increases was no easier than choosing the budget cuts.
End of Disc 1.